recovery. He had chosen to replace this room's dim lighting with an illusion he found particularly delightful. To anyone entering, it would appear that Sherrick and the baby floated among a sea of endless stars.
"I hope you don't mind," Sherrick said. "Do come in." I thought she might find a slight adjustment to her environment stimulating.
"She can't hear you, can she, Doc?"
"Not yet," Sherrick replied. "But her neural pathways develop daily. I assure you this will not inhibit that process in any way."
"I didn't think it would," Kim said. "It's actually very cool." At least once every day, Kim visited both Lieutenant Conlon and the baby. His current responsibilities prohibited lengthy stays, but that only intensified Sherrick's respect for Kim. Many in his position might not make the effort at all.
"The vibrations of the world around her are the critical thing at this point. Their presence alerts her developing synapses to the whole of which she is a part. Were she still developing in her mother's womb, the sensations would be constant. As that is no longer possible, I am spending as much time as I can compensating for the deficit, and encourage you and Lieutenant Conlon as soon as she is able to do the same. It would indeed be tragic should the child survive the next several months, for her to take her first breath unaware that she already belongs to a thriving community."
Kim moved to stand on the other side of the incubator and placed both hands on its smooth, transparent surface.
"Hi, sweetheart," he said. "It's your daddy."
"The processing power will still be insufficient, won't it?"
The doctor's voice sounded from the main medical bay. The doctor and Lieutenant Barclay had been working for the last several days toward a goal Sherrick was not at all sure he understood. They had clearly just returned from the main holodeck, where most of the research was currently centered.
"It depends entirely upon how independent you expect this program to be. Ideally, the lieutenant would have access to the entire ship. Confined to sickbay, she would probably run mad in short order."
There was a longish pause while Lieutenant Barclay apparently considered the problem.
"In order to maintain integrity, which will be crucial, we will have to run this program through its own discrete holographic generator. Linking it to the rest of the ship will produce a noticeable drag on other systems."
"Other holographic systems?"
"All systems," Barclay said. "During normal operations, no one would be likely to notice other than ops, but in battle or if other systems were critically damaged, it might be an issue. I won't place her neural patterns in a program that is vulnerable to the whims of Ensign Drurr."
Sherrick watched Kim's face as he, too, listened to this exchange. At first he seemed confused, trying to grasp the significance of the doctor's and Barclay's words. In a startling dawning of awareness, Kim hurried into the main bay. Sherrick patted the incubator, gently saying,
"I will return shortly,"
and hurried after Kim. Lieutenant Kim had placed himself between the doctor and Barclay.
"Whose neural patterns are we placing inside a hologram?"
he demanded. The doctor seemed peeved at first, but quickly shifted his countenance to one of patient concern. For his part, Barclay simply appeared devastated at the sight of Harry Kim. One of the things about humans that had most heartened Sherrick during the few years he had worked among them was the speed and ease with which they assumed one another's burdens.
"We haven't done anything yet," the doctor assured him.
"But you're talking about Nancy, right?"
The doctor nodded.
"Please forgive me for dropping eaves, but I do not understand," Sherrick admitted.
All three turned their attention to him, but it was Barclay who said,
"Technically it's not eavesdropping if we can all see you standing right here."
"Most appreciated, Lieutenant," Sherrick said.
"You want to do the same thing to Nancy that you did to Dinara Pell, right?"
Kim asked.
"If it becomes necessary,"
the doctor said.
"We're not there yet. But I want us to be prepared in the event we run out of other options."
"Gentlemen,"
Sherrick said insistently.
The doctor turned his attention to Sherrick. "As you know, Dr. Sherrick, Lieutenant Conlon's condition is progressing more rapidly than any of us thought possible."
"What about the stem cell therapy Dr. Sal was going to try?" Kim asked.
"Although she successfully harvested some cells, there weren't enough for her to create the appropriate therapeutic vectors,"
the doctor replied.
"I'm sorry, but that possibility no longer exists."
"So this is Plan B?"
"Think of it more like Plan Z," Barclay said. Turning to Sherrick, he continued, We know it is possible to temporarily transfer the neural patterns of an individual into a holomatrix. The doctor already successfully did so several years ago with a patient named Dinara Pell, who was suffering from the phage.
The phage? Sherrick asked.
As degenerative illnesses go, the phage made Lieutenant Conlon's condition look benign, the doctor said. The point is, until we can come up with a way to reverse the damage to her DNA, we need to do all we can to keep her body alive and to slow the progress of the condition. One way to do that is to place her in stasis. By transferring her neural patterns into a holographic matrix, she could continue to exist among us while we work on a more permanent solution.
Sherrick looked to Kim, who appeared to take the suggestion quite well.
How long do you think she could survive in a holomatrix? Kim asked.
The doctor shrugged.
That's the issue. A program like that requires an immense amount of free processing space, and Galen doesn't have it.
I'm working on a discrete interface with its own dedicated power source, Barclay said. The issue now is whether or not to tie it directly into a segregated section of the main computer, or keep the entire mechanism separate.
You trade power for security, Kim said, nodding.
We'll probably end up opting for the segregated processor, Barclay admitted. We just have to keep it operational during unexpected power distribution disruptions.
Do you really think it's going to come to that?
Kim asked.
The doctor shook his head. Dr. Sal is working on an alternative theory as we speak. She hasn't yet shared her progress, but we all believe she is the most likely among us to find the mechanism to reverse the damage repair syndrome. Our focus is keeping the lieutenant alive until she succeeds.
But is that life? Sherrick asked.
Again, all three directed their attention toward him. This time, from the looks of confusion between them, Sherrick wondered if he had unconsciously briefly lapsed into his native tongue.
It is not life as you experience it, Dr. Sherrick, the doctor admitted. For anyone who has been organic, it would seem like a pale shadow of the existence they once knew.
But you cannot know, Sherrick said. You have never been anything other than what you are.
In point of fact, I did once share my consciousness with Sevens. It was a fleeting gift, but during that time I was able to grasp more than you might imagine of what it is to be organic. To taste food. To feel the touch of another.
An elemental sadness seemed to momentarily overtake the doctor, but he quickly shook it off.
While holographic existence cannot compare to the sensations available to an organic being, it is not intolerable, and in this case might be the best way to protect her neural patterns from degrading along with her body.
You will, of course, give Lieutenant Conlon the option to refuse, Sherrick asked.
Yes, the doctor said, but I doubt she would.
I doubt she would accept, Sherrick said.
The doctor appeared taken aback, perhaps even insulted.
Why do you say that? Kim asked.
Sherrick sighed deeply.
What you are suggesting might be an effective temporary solution. You might see it as a brief vacation from one's natural state, a short respite. I submit to you, however, that such a radical shift in one's ability to perceive and interact with their environment could be terribly destabilizing.
It wasn't for Dr. Pell, the doctor said. In fact, in the end, she resisted returning to her body. So preferable did she find living as a hologram.
Sherrick shook his head.
I cannot speak for this woman, Sherrick said. And perhaps given the alternative, Lieutenant Conlon might feel the same. But surely part of our role as healers is to prepare those we cannot save for acceptance of their imminent death. To postpone the inevitable and to do so in such a radical way seems, I am not sure if this is the right word, but disrespectful?
Kim stepped toward Sherrick, his face drawn in tight lines.
I can't speak for Nancy either. But should it come to this, I will do everything I can to convince her to attempt this alternative. Death is inevitable for all of us, but as healers, it is your responsibility to put it off as long as possible using every means at your disposal.
Sherrick considered Kim. He understood that the young man was unwilling to accept the reality that his beloved and the mother of his child might not survive. He felt immense pity for the lieutenant. But that did not change his belief that this solution, marvelous as it might seem in the abstract, could do more damage to Lieutenant Conlon than the alternative. She had already been forced to contend with one violation of her consciousness by an alien life form. That act of aggression was responsible for her current medical condition. While he did not doubt the intentions of the doctor, Barclay, or Kim, he did fear that they were acting more in their own interests than Conlan's. He resolved to keep these fears to himself, but to bring them to the attention of Counselor Cambridge at the earliest opportunity.
"It will, of course, be Lieutenant Conlan's decision," Sherrick said. "Now if you will excuse me, I will return to your daughter. Before you go, you should spend some time speaking with Lieutenant Conlan. The same positive effects I described for your child will also apply to her, even in a comatose state."
Kim nodded.
"I will. Thank you, Doctor."
Sherrick had only lived among the variety of alien species present in the Federation for a few years. He respected them tremendously, particularly their tenacity. But one belief the children of Tama embraced that he feared these men never could was the certainty that death was not an end. It was merely a transitional state. To deny it was to deny the preciousness of life itself, and to live in fear of it was to endure constant, unnecessary anxiety. Like them, he hoped Lieutenant Conlan would survive. Unlike them, he knew that either way, she would endure. How she did so mattered. Inflicting intense mental suffering in the name of a few more days or weeks seemed cruel. Sherrick hoped dearly that this option, however well-intentioned, would never become reality. 9. Shuttlecraft Van Cease.
"What about that one?" Ensign Gwyn asked.
"No," Seven replied.
"No,"
Gwyn repeated in her head, consciously modulating it to recreate the satisfyingly petulant sass of her 5-year-old self when she'd asked to spend a few more minutes splashing in the creek before dinner time and been refused by her mother. It had taken them only 2 hours to reach the asteroid belt surrounding the B-Star. The rest of Gwyn's life was apparently going to be devoted to finding the most perfect chunk of rock among them for Seven to sample.
"It's almost the right size."
"Size is not the issue."
"Then what is?"
"Adjust your course bearing 48 Mark 2-1, Seven requested.
"Like everything else in the Federation, courtesy is free." This had been a favorite phrase of Gwyn's leady, Mela Fui, a dear friend of her mother who had attended every large and small family gathering, from Gwyn's birth to her going-away celebration before her departure for the Academy. They still corresponded often.
"More often than Vara and I come to think of it."
As well as Vara knew her daughter, Mela's insight into her favorite daughter of the heart was uncanny. Often she didn't even need to see Atar to know something was up. She'd just happen to knock on the door the day before a big test, or the day after a fight with a close friend. There would be long walks and hot Soria cakes, and somehow everything would look different, better than it had before she'd come. When she'd been a girl, Gwyn had often feared her mother. She missed Vara, but on her worst days, ached for Mela's company. Inside, Gwyn was cursing Seven's obliviousness. Mela would have remonstrated Gwyn for allowing her impatience to fester. It cost Seven nothing to be courteous when suggesting a heading, especially as she was a mission specialist with no rank and technically couldn't order Gwyn to do anything. But Gwyn was not obligated to take offense. That was a choice. To allow the whims of others to determine one's own internal state was to cede power. If Gwyn was going to give hers up so cheaply, she deserved the pain and frustration that accompanied the sensation of weakness.
"Course altered."
Seven did not respond.
"You're welcome."
Though the asteroid belt was relatively dense, they were navigating an area free of the smaller rocks that made traversing such fields so hazardous. Seven had her sights set on a fragment large enough to land the shuttle on, and with enough gravity to allow both of them to take an EV walk without running the risk of flying off the surface. They'd already passed 6 such sites for reasons Gwyn could only guess at. Apparently Seven didn't feel the need to confide in anyone else. Of course, for most of her life, she'd had no choice about that. Being Borg meant your thoughts were never your own.
"Maybe she's overcorrected her course," Gwyn thought.
"It might be too generous. Seven could just feel so superior to everyone else that no one else's ideas were worthy of consideration. But placing Seven's actions in a context that suggested a less insulting reading made Gwyn feel marginally better. Gwyn smiled gently at the realization that Mela would have been pleased. Focusing her attention on the asteroid they were now approaching, Gwyn could see that the surface conditions were visibly different from the others Seven had rejected. Most of the asteroids were boring variations of red, brown, and gray. This one sported several wide veins of metal circling it. A glance at Seven's sensor panel showed massive deposits of several common and a few unusual minerals. "You're looking for more of the element we discovered back on the planet, aren't you?" Gwyn ventured.
"Not precisely."
"Which part did I get wrong?"
"I am looking for a fragment that most closely matches the planet's geological makeup," Seven replied. "I do not expect to find substantial levels of the Seven of Nanonium anywhere in this field."
Gwyn swallowed the anxiety that immediately welled within her at Seven's casual use of a term she had intended as a joke. "I'm sorry about that, Seven. I hope you didn't take offense." For the first time since their mission had begun, Seven turned to face Gwyn, her features a complacent mask revealing nothing.
"What I wouldn't give to be able to do that," Gwyn thought.
"I did not," Seven said with unexpected sincerity. "But I would question its accuracy as a designation."
"Well, yeah. It's kind of a silly word," Gwyn agreed. "But it's not unprecedented. We've also got Einsteinium, Curium, Californium."
"Each of those designations was assigned to acknowledge significant scientific contributions of the individuals they were named for," Seven said. "While I detected the unusual properties of the new element, I could not have done so without the tools Starfleet has put at my disposal, or the efforts of the crews of our fleet's various vessels. Perhaps Starfleetium, or Full Circlium, would be more appropriate."
Her face was still a mask, but a new, faint light flickered from Seven's eyes at this. She might have been teasing Gwyn. For the first time since they'd met, Gwyn felt as if she was conversing with Seven rather than simply doing her bidding. It was a heady sensation. She'd never appreciated Patel's longing to be included among the closer senior staff. Tasting that acceptance, as Patel surely had in the past, it made significantly more sense. "I think I see a safe spot to land if this one looks promising," Gwyn said, bringing the shuttle closer to the thickly veined asteroid. Much of the surface was composed of jagged peaks and narrow, deep valleys, inhospitable but not entirely unmanageable for a pilot with Gwyn's skills. The shuttle's short-range sensors directed her attention to a high plain, roughly 3 kilometers wide, which would do nicely as a base of operations for their rock collecting.
"I will transmit our coordinates and intention to land back to Voyager," Seven said. "Take us in, Ensign."
"Adjusting course and matching speed to bring us within the asteroid's gravitational field," Gwyn said. Within half an hour, she had brought them safely to the surface. After 2 hours of essential EV safety preparations, their explorations began. DK-1116. The first priority, once Patel and Lazarin had caught their breath and assured themselves that they could survive indefinitely in the cavern, was to make contact with Vincent. Devi didn't doubt for a moment that J'Pel had returned to the surface as she'd ordered, and that he and Vincent were likely having kittens at the moment. Had she been in their shoes, she would have contacted Voyager and requested a targeted sensor scan to confirm her and Lazarin's life signs beneath the surface. It was likely that the heavy metals surrounding them might disrupt sensors, but a skilled enough operator, and Lazarin's replacement, Vanessa Waters, was certainly one, would be able to find their signals. Both she and Lazarin had carried spare air tanks. They couldn't have traded them out while underwater, but they would use them when they returned to the surface. If Vincent didn't hear from them and Voyager was able to get a clear transporter lock, they'd be transported out before their explorations could begin. Refusing to give in to dismal speculation, Patel opened her comlink.
"Patel to Vincent, do you read me?
Vincent?
Are you there?"
A sharp burst of static pierced her eardrum.
"Ow!"
Patel said, pulling her mask away from her ear. Lazarin had removed his as well and was tinkering with it with a tiny metal tool.
What are you doing? She asked.
Switching to our main emergency band,
Lazarin replied.
Our ship's communications array is a little larger than Vincent's remote unit.
Seconds later, he lifted the unit to his ear and said,
Lazarin to Voyager, do you copy?
Hey, Kenth!
The warm voice of Waters reverberated through the cavern.
Vincent just made contact, reporting that you and Patel were probably dead.
I told him we'd run a few more scans before notifying your next of kin. What happened? We found our way into an underground cavern. It's got atmosphere, and we've got spare tanks and plenty of power left in our lights. We're going to do some looking around. Is there any chance you can get a transporter lock on us?
Affirmative. We've got you.
Don't pull us out without our authorization. And tell Vincent not to worry. Have him switch his comm signal to this band and await further instructions. We'll be in touch.
Understood. Good hunting.
Lazarin out.
That was quick thinking, Patel commended him.
Lazarin shrugged. Emergency comm protocol 101.
I knew there was a reason I wanted to be on your team, Patel said.
Don't worry, I won't let it go to my head,
Lazarin teased. Playing his light over the cavern walls, he continued,
What do you think this place is?
Patel had been formulating hypotheses from the moment they'd surfaced. Checking her tricorder, she was thrilled to see new geological data populating her screen.
I have a theory, she admitted, stepping past him and focusing her hand beacon on a large metallic deposit 20 meters beyond their position.
The ledge between her and the area wasn't wide, but she stepped carefully to avoid slipping back into the water.
Your scans confirmed lots of large caverns in this direction.
Many of them read as being filled with water, but obviously some of them aren't. Beyond them, a little deeper, are a number of sensor holes. They could indicate anything.
So you're telling me that when you risked our lives getting here, you did it on a solid hunch that this cavern was here?
Patel turned to face Lazarin. She knew lying to a Betazoid was pointless, but even if that hadn't been true, he deserved the truth.
I knew it was possible.
50-50?
More like 80-20.
Lazarin shook his head.
I understand wanting to make your mark and get ahead. But the next time you pull a stunt like that, you're doing it alone.
Patel nodded.
Understood.
They continued along the edge of the water for 20 more meters, until the shore widened at a vast wall composed largely of the same metallic ore that had marked the entrance to the cavern.
These deposits share certain characteristics with the osmium constructs in other biodomes,
Lazarin noted,
but they are significantly denser and more varied.
Patel stepped forward and ran her gloved hand along the nearest metal band.
I wonder if this was the source of the materials used to construct them.
Without analyzing all of them, I couldn't say. But I don't think so. There's none of Seven's element here.
But our scans detected large amounts of it in this area.
Those deposits aren't anywhere near here,
Lazarin said, shrugging. Patel continued studying the wall, stepping gingerly along the shore. Suddenly her breath caught in her throat.
Devi?
She had turned her body to face the wall and was wiping both hands over it.
This is smooth. There's a door here, she said.
Lazarin joined her, brushing away several layers of dirt until large sections of a perfectly smooth circular door were revealed.
Should we knock?
Lazarin asked.
Because there's someone back there 4,000 years later who can answer?
Patel asked.
I was kidding.
There's no handle or hinges or visible activation panel, she said.
Perhaps it only opens from the other side.
Patel stepped back, playing her light around the edges of the door.
Do you see anything that looks like a manual override?
Lazarin studied the rest of the wall but found nothing. Stepping forward, he said,
I'm going to try something.
Placing both hands on the door, he closed his eyes and slowed his breath. He seemed to be listening really hard, but the only sound was the faint lapping of the water at the shoreline. After a few minutes like this, he opened his eyes.
There's something here.
Patel's eyes widened.
Could you possibly be more specific?
Lazarin shook his head.
I'm not getting a person, individual consciousness per se. but there is something that feels like life. Something pretty big.
Patel swallowed hard. Her heart rate accelerated and she felt her extremities begin to tremble. To steady them, she reached again for her tricorder.
I'm not reading any life signs.
It's not life like we're life, Devi. It's powerful, but not terribly organized, if that makes sense.
Lazarin removed one of his diving gloves and ran his hand over the surface of the door. Near the center of it, he paused, resting his hand there.
What is it?
I think it's getting warmer here.
Suddenly, the door was illuminated by a bright blue light. It looked like an energy field had snapped into existence, but it carried no current. Patel quickly removed both her gloves and placed her hands next to his.
It could be biosensitive, she suggested.
They waited there for almost a minute, until the light vanished. Patel emitted a frustrated huff.
What are we doing wrong?
It's automated. It sensed our presence, but maybe it recognized us as someone who isn't allowed to access this area.
Or maybe it needs more data, Patel posited.
What kind of data?
Patel squared her shoulders and placed her hands on the door once again.
I am Lieutenant Devi Patel of the Federation Starship Voyager. I am human, and my planet of origin is approximately 50,000 light-years from our present position. We come in peace, and seek only to better understand this world and those who inhabited it.
Both waited tensely for a few moments for any response. When none came, Lazarin added,
Devi is an Aries and in her spare time enjoys calculating black hole densities and kayaking.
The blue light returned, but this time only in a small circle near the center of the door. Patel inhaled sharply. She moved her right hand so that it rested within the lit area and immediately noted a difference.
It's not solid anymore, she said. It's softer, squishier.
Seconds later, Patel cried out and pulled her hand back in alarm.
What happened?
It cut me, she said,
holding her hand under Lazarin's light. A circle of shallow pricks could clearly be seen on her palm. They weren't deep, but small drops of blood bloomed and pooled in her palm.
I've got a small med kit,
Lazarin said, shrugging out of his shoulder pack.
Don't worry about it,
Patel said, wiping her hand on her dive suit and staring at the door, transfixed. Lazarin followed her gaze and watched as the brightness at the center of the door expanded again. It grew so intense that both of them had to look away, shielding their eyes. When they looked back, the door was gone. Beyond it, darkness beckoned. Surface of unnamed asteroid. Seven was not at all certain what she expected to find on this asteroid.
A clue as to the composition of the other bodies that were once part of this solar system?
Possibly. But in her heart, she was also seeking the answer to an absurd question that had nonetheless plagued her from the moment she'd begun to study the binaries.
Where did the B star come from?
It was an absurd question because most often, binary stars were simply formed when the disk of gas and dust surrounding a new star fragmented and a second star was created. Gravitational capture of a second star by the first was not impossible, just highly unlikely, and required a third body with sufficient gravity to account for the required conservation of mass. But as Admiral Janeway had noted during their first briefing, the size and composition of the B-star's asteroid belt suggested the fairly recent destruction of one or more terrestrial bodies. For her, this was the essential mystery of this system, and might actually hold the key to understanding the alien species that had created the biodomes on DK-1116. If the asteroids were composed primarily of the same material as the surviving planet, that would argue for normal binary formation with possible orbit loss resulting in destruction of one or more former planets. If the asteroids contained significant amounts of material that was quite different, her belief that the binaries had been formed by a rare instance of gravitational capture would gain credence.
There is a significant deposit of a composite metal just ahead, Gwyn's voice sounded through the comm system of Seven's EV suit.
Seven adjusted her tricorder, directing it toward the site Gwyn had indicated.
There are trace heavy metals,
Iron, iridium, chromium. But the largest concentrations appear to be unique alloys,
Seven said, as the list before her continued to expand.
That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Gwyn asked.
Could you state your query more precisely, Ensign?
Seven asked. After a brief pause, during which Ensign Gwyn was probably biting back her first few responses, she said,
What I mean is, aren't relatively few alloys naturally occurring?
Did you not study basic mineralogy, chemistry, and molecular geology at the Academy?
I did. I passed those classes, but never excelled at them. I always knew I was going to fly and figured I could leave the study of the worlds we were flying toward to everybody else on the ship,
Gwyn replied, with a level of honesty Seven found strangely endearing. Most Starfleet officers considered themselves to be the best of the best. Competition among them was fierce in order to gain admission to the Academy, and only intensified from there. Few individuals Seven had served with would have been as eager to admit to their shortcomings as Ensign Gwyn. It was true that in her case, her skill as a pilot so thoroughly dwarfed most of the other pilots Seven had known, short of Commander Paris, that her choice to focus her efforts there had certainly borne fruit.
They are, Seven replied, but that does not necessarily rule out natural formation here. More interesting are the traces of significantly less common elements, many with brief half-lives and unstable isotopes.
So that's weird.
Yes, Ensign.
Does it mean anything?
It suggests several hypotheses, none of which we are going to be able to confirm until we extract samples and return to Voyager.
So I should just shut up and start digging?
In the bulky EV suit, it was difficult to simply turn one's head and see another's facial expressions. Seven made the effort, turning her entire torso around to face Gwyn. Despite her words, the ensign was smiling.
We will both start digging, Seven said.
Pointing out the nearest deposit, a massive reflective vein running through a large rock directly ahead, Seven said,
Begin here. Extract 10 discrete small samples. Try and get as many unique alloys as possible. I will do the same from our secondary site.
Yes, ma'am,
Gwyn said cheerfully enough as she dropped her tool pack to the ground and began rummaging around in it for her phaser. Seven moved off to study another formation roughly 100 meters down a gentle slope that burst from the surface of the asteroid in an unusual spiked shape. She retrieved her phaser and set it at the lowest possible strength for cutting. A tight, steady beam was emitted, and Seven began to extract extremely fine slices from the odd deposit.
So, is one of your hypotheses that this asteroid used to be part of another planet in this system?
Gwyn asked.
Most stars have planets, usually more than one, Seven said patiently. It is possible that the secondary star of this binary pair entered this system after it was formed, and in doing so destroyed any other terrestrial worlds that might have existed prior to its arrival.
How does taking samples of these deposits help you confirm that?
Are you asking for your own edification, Ensign?
Actually, I'm pretty sure that once we get back, Devi is going to test me on every single aspect of this mission, and I want to be prepared to answer her questions.
Lieutenant Patel is welcome to read the reports I will file once our mission is complete.
Oh, she'll definitely read them. She'll probably commit them to memory. It's not the data she'll be interested in.
That didn't make much sense to Seven. As Chief Science Officer, Lieutenant Patel should concern herself with all of Voyager's scientific discoveries.
I do not understand, Seven admitted.
Devi's really smart.
I do not disagree.
A light chuckle echoed through the comm system.
But she tends to think about problems the way we were taught at the Academy. Every situation is a test she thinks she might fail. So she plays things safe. She never wants to do anything wrong.
Some errors are essential to discovery,
Seven said, slicing another shard and depositing it in her pack.
That's probably true, but it doesn't mean that it feels good to make them. You make connections that Devi can't seem to find. She lives inside the box. For you, it's like there is no box. She might eventually reach the same conclusions you do, but she won't get there the same way. There will be lots more trial and a lot less error, and she won't ever go out on a limb with a fringe theory unless she's sure she can prove it.
What she's looking for in your reports is the train of thought that led you to any particular discovery. She thinks you're better at this than she is, so she wants to be more like you. I keep telling her she needs to relax. She's her own worst enemy, if that makes sense.
It does. But Lieutenant Patel should not compare herself to me or anyone else in the fleet. Each of us has a unique role to play, and many ways in which we can contribute to the fleet's work.
Forgive me, Seven, but that's easy to say when everyone already knows you're brilliant.
All of Lieutenant Patel's superior officers believe her to be a valued member of our crew, Seven said.
Have they ever told her that? Gwyn asked.
I do not know. I have never participated in the crew review process.
What the?
Ensign, is something wrong?
Gwyn's voice was faint, and the comm now carried a strange crackling sound to Seven's ears. It sounded like something was interfering with her signal.
None of these metals are supposed to be in liquid form, are they?
Gwyn asked. You should limit your samples to those available on the surface. At greater depths, it is possible—
I don't understand! The tricorder isn't making any sense of— What the hell is that?
The fear in Gwyn's voice made Seven drop her tools on the spot and move immediately back toward Gwyn's position.
Ow! That's really— Ouch! What the— Seven? No! No! Seven!
EV suits weren't designed to allow running, but Seven pushed herself, taking large, bounding steps to move as quickly as possible.
Calm yourself, Ensign.
A loud screech sounded over the comm that resolved into steady white noise.
Ensign? Ensign Gwyn, please respond, Seven said.
A few meters farther and she gained the top of the rise that led back to Gwyn's position. The sight that met her eyes was horrifying. Gwyn had fallen to her knees, holding her right arm out in front of her, waving it wildly. Her right hand and forearm were covered in a thick, viscous black fluid. It moved of its own accord past her elbow toward her shoulder. With the comm channel malfunctioning, Seven could not hear anything, but as soon as she reached Gwyn's position, she could see that within her suit, Gwyn was screaming. Seven moved to grasp Gwyn's left arm and studied her display panel. It was flashing bright red and indicated multiple breaches. Her oxygen supply was rapidly depleting, and the suit was detecting unacceptably high levels of radiation. The black fluid was still moving. Seven searched the ground and quickly retrieved Gwyn's phaser. She adjusted the setting to stun and aimed it directly at the strange black substance. A quick burst, and the fluid seemed to solidify. Gwyn fell to the ground, limp and unconscious. Whatever the substance was, it was obviously corrosive and possibly toxic, but there was no way to get Gwyn back to the shuttle without the protection the rest of her suit still provided. Careful not to touch the substance herself, Seven grabbed a rock and used it to try and remove a little of the black goo that had solidified upon contact with the phaser beam. It fell from Gwyn's suit in dry flakes.
Hang on, Ensign, Seven ordered as she lifted Gwyn over her shoulder and carried her back to the shuttle.
DK-1116 Lieutenant Patel started forward into the darkness.
Whoa!
Lazrin said sharply, grabbing her by the back of her wetsuit and tugging.
What?
Patel demanded.
We're not going in there alone.
Patel looked around the cavern.
There's no one else here, and I'm not going to wait for J'Pel and Vincent to risk the dive.
Lazrin shook his head.
You're so intent on finding whatever is back there, you're not thinking straight. We don't have to wait for them to dive down here. Voyager's transporter room has a lock on our position.
Oh, right, Patel said, chagrined.
Plus, don't you think we should share this with the rest of our team? Isn't that part of the point of this exercise? All of us working together?
Patel activated her comm badge. Patel to Voyager. Waters responded.
Go ahead, Devi.
A few minutes later, J'Pel and Vincent materialized in the cavern, a few meters from the open doorway.
Wow,
Vincent said, playing his light all around him.
This is amazing.
You know what I bet is even more amazing? Patel asked.
What?
Whatever is back here behind the hidden door Lazrin and I found. Let's move.
J'Pel was quiet.
simply studying his tricorder readings. Lazarin could sense unspoken anger studiously controlled.
Omar?
Lazarin said softly, stepping close to him. The young Bajoran lifted his dark brown eyes to meet Kent's.
Not now, they demanded.
Much as Lazarin wanted to respect Japel's wishes, he wasn't about to enter an alien environment with a team member harboring resentment toward one or more of the rest of them.
Look, he began, I don't know what we're going to find down here, but I do know that if it's problematic, the only way we're going to survive it is by trusting one another.
Lazarin could see Japel's jaw clenching.
Whatever you have to say, you should say it,
Lazarin continued. Some of the tension Japel was holding seemed to release. Turning to Patel, he said,
Lieutenant Patel, a word?
What is it?
Japel stared at her for a long moment, then shook his head.
What you just did, endangering all of us in hopes of discovering this, was bullshit. I know you fancy yourself the leader of this mission, but I will not follow anyone who is careless about my safety or their own.
Patel absorbed this, then stepped closer to him.
I apologize, she said coldly. It was a risk, but a calculated one. I didn't have time to explain it, but the odds were good, based on my readings of our most recent scans, that this cavern was here. You don't have to like following me. But I am the senior officer, so if that doesn't work for you, speak now, and you can transport back to the surface. I'm sure there's time to assign you to another team, maybe one that's planning a little flower gathering or sunbathing.
Lazarin didn't like where this was going one bit, but he also knew Patel was the only one who could solve it, were she the least bit inclined to do so.
Devi,
Lazarin said.
What?
The only operative words there were the first two you spoke. The rest only added insult to injury.
We don't have time for this.
This is the reason we're all down here. We're the next generation of Starfleet's finest. Most of our current commanding officers have been at this for decades. They weren't handed their jobs, they earned them. And if we expect to take their place, this is how we demonstrate our readiness. You made a mistake. None of us care that it panned out. It was still wrong. We need to know that this was a momentary lapse, not a character flaw. Acknowledge that, or we'll be forced to conclude that we might be dealing with a reckless officer and act accordingly.
You know why I did it, Kenth, Patel said. You know how hard I worked, preparing for this. On any other mission, a find like this would be given to more senior officers. Together, we're all about to prove that we're every bit as capable as they are of contributing to our work in a meaningful way.
I've never questioned my ability to contribute to this fleet's missions, Japel said. My status as a junior officer is a simple function of lack of experience.
Exactly. And this is how we fix that, Patel insisted.
Not entirely, Lazarin corrected her. You have a choice to make here, Devi. You can be the officer who made this discovery at the expense of your credibility, or the one who realized in a critical moment that leadership isn't about being smart or being right. It's about protecting those you lead and making sure they understand what you're asking them to risk and why.
Captain Chakotay doesn't explain every command decision he makes to us, Patel pointed out.
He doesn't have to. There isn't a single officer serving on Voyager who doubts his commitment to our safety. You think his choice to send the most experienced officers he has on missions like this is a judgment on your lack of ability. It isn't. It's about assessing risks and setting realistic expectations. We all get our chances to show we're ready for more responsibility. This is yours, and we all want to see you succeed. So please stop screwing it up.
Patel's face flushed. A bevy of conflicting emotions swelled within her. Lazarin couldn't help but empathize. He could only hope that she would accept the life preserver he was offering. Finally, she said,
You're right. I'm sorry. Japel, Vincent, I sincerely apologize for frightening you both. It was careless. I was only thinking of myself, and that's unacceptable. Can you forgive me?
Lazarin, Vincent, and Japel exchanged glances and nodded.
Thank you, Lieutenant, Japel said. That's all I needed to hear. Guys?
Vincent asked.
Yes,
Patel replied.
Was that light always there?
All three turned to peer down the hallway, where a faint blue light now lit what appeared to be a long corridor.
No, it wasn't, Patel said.
Tricorders, please.
All four began to scan the hallway ahead.
A new power source has been activated, Patel noted.
Something knows we're here, Lazarin said.
Is that your empathic abilities talking? Japel asked.
Yes, as well as the fact that we had to endure a weird and invasive identification protocol to get the door to open,
Lazarin said.
Do you sense hostility? Patel asked.
Lazarin shook his head.
No, it's still just a sense of presence, nothing more.
Patel removed a phaser from her pack.
I'll feel better if we all arm ourselves, she said.
Agreed,
Japel said.
I'll take point. Lazarin, will you bring up the rear?
Yes, Lieutenant.
We'll go slow and take as many detailed scans as possible. We can analyze the data later. Let's just focus on collection for now.
Understood,
Lazarin said. The first 100 meters of the corridor were traversed with an overwhelming sense of tense expectation. The walls were bare, seamless metal plates composed largely of iron, copper, and aluminum. There were no visible doors or junctions. They followed a gentle downward slope until they reached the source of the light. At the end of the corridor stood another open doorway. It was circular, similar to but larger than the one at the entrance. Patel entered first, and Lazarin could hear her catch her breath in what felt to him like awe. Vincent and Japel hurried in after her. By the time Lazarin passed over the threshold, the other three had reached the center of the room. They faced outward, staring open-mouthed at the walls of the vast space. Lazarin joined them, moving to Patel's side. The entire room was lined with tiny alcoves carved into the walls. Each alcove contained a small sphere, roughly a dozen centimeters in diameter. Each sphere was illuminated from within with a pale blue light. Although the effect was similar to a massive collection of light bulbs, Lazarin did not for a moment believe that the sphere's purpose was as a light source. Lazarin's heart began to race. The sight was beautiful and mysterious, but fascinating as it was, nothing in this room felt like the presence he continued to sense.
What is this?
Japel asked for all of them.
My tricorder isn't giving me anything, Patel said. It's like they don't exist.
There could be a scattering field of some kind. Whatever is powering them wasn't detectable from the surface. Maybe there is an automated security program,
Vincent offered. The spheres were too high to reach. Lazarin tore his eyes from them and began to search the rest of the room. That's when he noticed the other three circular doors spaced evenly about the walls. He appreciated the symmetry. If nothing else, it gave him the distinct sense of purposeful construction.
I want to try something, Patel said. Each of you go and stand by one of the doors. Don't touch them. I just want to see if they react to proximity.
Lazarin, Vincent, and Japel did as they had been instructed. Nothing happened. Patel moved along the outer circumference of the room, walking slowly, tricorder in hand.
There are faint electromagnetic waves emanating from the center, she said, looking to Lazarin.
With a shrug and a nod, he urged her on. She carefully stepped back toward dead center of the room. When she reached it, a blue pillar of light blinked into existence. It was impossible to tell if it came from above or below her position.
Are you okay, Devi?
Lazarin asked. Bathed in the incandescent glow, she smiled and nodded.
You have to see this,
she said, motioning them to step closer. As they did, Lazarin realized that within the pillar, strange glowing symbols floated.
Is that a control interface?
Japel asked.
I think so, Patel said. But since I can't translate any of them, I don't want to touch anything.
Step out for a second,
Lazarin suggested. She did so, and the blue pillar vanished.
That's amazing,
Vincent said.
Let's test the doors,
Lazarin suggested. Patel nodded.
One at a time.
Together they moved to the door directly across from the open entrance. As she had done before, Patel placed a hand in the center and said,
I am Lieutenant Devi Patel.
Before she could finish introducing herself, the walls all around her began to scream. Ten. DK-1116. Liam O'Donnell did not believe in impossible things. He operated best in quantifiable domains. His entire career had been an exercise in pushing the limits of life forms. Things that on the surface seemed difficult or impossible, with enough time, patience, and scrutiny, eventually revealed their secrets and became the clay in his hands from which he created new, unique things. In some ways, this entire planet felt like a similar exercise. But he had not designed this system. Someone else, someone he suspected was infinitely more capable than he, had set all of this in motion and then brought it to a screeching halt. As of yet, he had no idea how they had accomplished this miracle. He was an outsider, and its tantalizing mysteries had slowly transmuted from interesting to annoying.
Impossible.
O'Donnell thought for the 100th time since he began sampling the wide variety of plant life that populated the biodome.
I'm curious to know what you make of all of this, Commander, Admiral Janeway called from over his shoulder.
So intent had he been on observing the regeneration of a single blade of tall white grass, O'Donnell hadn't registered her soft footfalls as she approached his position. Tearing his eyes away from the magnificent, improbable spectacle, he rose to face her.
Have you reached any conclusions, Admiral?
A mischievous smile played across her lips.
Chakotay and I believe we might be dealing with zombies.
O'Donnell laughed aloud at this.
The living dead. I suppose that's as good a description as any.
Commander Glenn found a lovely spot for stargazing on the top of one of those hills back there. We thought we'd make camp and have dinner. She and Chakotay are setting things up. I was hoping you'd join us. There's not much light left. Walk with me?
The commander collected his tools and specimens and joined the admiral as she led him to their evening campsite.
What about Regina?
He asked as soon as they were underway.
She finds this place disturbing. She'll be back shortly, but she's left the analysis to us for the time being.
She's not the only one,
O'Donnell said.
Everything here that looks like life is something else. It's not exactly artificial. The limited cellular analysis I have been able to do shows trace nucleic acids, but they only seem to activate under certain circumstances. The gene regulators involved are more complex by several orders of magnitude than anything governing most life forms, which, as you know, are already insanely complex.
Janeway slowed her pace as they reached another patch of the tall white fronds.
Do you think it's something we could replicate?
O'Donnell shrugged, carving his own path alongside the admiral's.
Our tools can give us accurate readings at the subatomic level, but just because we can see something and understand its purpose doesn't mean we can recreate it ourselves, let alone build upon progress like this.
Like Seven's catoms?
Exactly. In some ways, this seems like a variation on programmable matter. It's the fossilized helix and trace nucleic acids that make this more difficult. But catoms are matter designed to sustain life. They are not in and of themselves living things. These are.
Sometimes.
Exactly. Sometimes.
If it weren't for the fact that it doesn't seem like anyone has been here for a few thousand years, I would say that what we are witnessing here is a grand experiment,
the admiral said.
Whoever left these biodomes here didn't secure them. They didn't make them inaccessible. And given the level of mastery of both technology and biology we've already found, my guess is that if they'd wanted to, they could have.
You think they left them here as a challenge? See what we did and let us know if you think you can do better?
O'Donnell asked. Janeway smiled at the thought.
I feel like if they had intended for anyone to follow in their footsteps, they would have left instructions, a message, something to help guide those who came after them.
Maybe they didn't think anyone would. Most of the space around this area used to belong to the Borg. That might not have been the case when these biodomes were erected. And it's really interesting to me that the Borg never seemed to have come here.
It's easy to get the wrong idea about the Borg, to give them far more credit than they deserve. Advanced, efficient, and destructive as they weren't gods. They were not capable of mastering anything they couldn't assimilate, and nothing here would have responded to assimilation, nor are the natural resources that unique.
The Seven of Ninonium is.
The Admiral turned on him with her most withering glare.
We're not calling it that.
I am. I think it's a perfect designation.
Yes, well, we will never know how many interesting anomalies and good ideas the Borg failed to notice along the way, Janeway said.
I'm kind of glad they never came this way, or wrote it off. This kind of technology isn't really safe in anyone's hands, least of all theirs.
What about ours?
O'Donnell paused his steps and crossed his arms, considering the Admiral.
I have plenty of faith in the essential goodness of our people, especially now that I have a much broader basis for comparison.
One of these days, you're going to have to let go of your anger with the Confederacy of the Worlds of the First Quadrant.
Maybe, but not today. And I wasn't actually thinking about them. I was thinking about the Krenim.
Janeway inhaled deeply and exhaled very slowly, clearly purging her own complicated emotions on that subject.
What I find most worrisome about anyone who would turn to time manipulation to accomplish political ends is their stunning lack of faith in themselves, O'Donnell said.
Janeway smiled in spite of herself, resuming her previous meandering pace.
It's hard to equate arrogance like that with insecurity.
Tell me I'm wrong.
You aren't. I just never thought of it that way.
All of these incredibly powerful civilizations have one thing in common. The Federation, the Borg, the Kaliar, the Confederacy, and the Krenim. They all develop unique tools in the name of progress. They each set lofty goals for themselves and harness those tools in the service of reaching those goals. But of all of them, ours seems to be the only one still confused about our ultimate purpose.
Confused? I don't believe that's true. Our goal is to learn as much as we can about the universe we inhabit, and all of those with whom we share it.
And if along the way we find others whose purpose conflicts with our own?
We prioritize our survival, while doing all we can to forward the notion of peaceful coexistence.
But how devoted are we to that peaceful coexistence thing? How devoted can we be when our existence is threatened so frequently by species who will never give us the same respect we are willing to extend to them? We kill others to preserve ourselves and our way of life.
As a last resort.
But still, it's always there. We don't send ships out to explore without arming them.
Are you, of all people, arguing for greater pacifism from us?
No, not at all. I like living, and I intend to continue doing it for as long as possible. I'm saying a little more humility on all our parts might be in order.
Humility?
Even the Kaliar weren't above making horrific mistakes. They knew their technology to be beyond that of most of their spacefaring contemporaries, and responded by hiding themselves as best they could from the rest of the universe. Whoever created this is playing at the same level. But they left their work here for anyone passing by to visit and study. This construct is meant to outlive us all. And I think you're wrong about them not leaving instructions. Everything we need to understand this technology and its purpose is right here. But it's only meant for the taking by those wise enough, advanced enough, and humble enough to see it for what it is.
What is it?
I'm starting to think we're not ready to find out.
Janeway smiled.
Patience and faith, Commander. Those two things have taken me a lot further than humility.
Patience and faith? two qualities I have never managed to cultivate.
Stick around long enough and they might just rub off on you.
In the distance, O'Donnell spotted the shadowed figures of Chakotay and Glenn moving around a small, stationary light source.
I hope not, he said.
Should I be insulted by that?
Janeway asked semi-